The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. GI Surgery Review, Indications and Complications, What to Look For, is presented by Dr. Catherine Kirchen.
Okay, so we'll start with surgery for gastroesophageal reflux disease. It's reserved for patients with complications from GERD or patients that have refractory esophagitis. That's probably the most frequent reason why patients get referred to surgery. Strictures, Barrett's are much less common. And persistent symptoms despite acid suppression is another reason patients get referred. We'll say that most patients that respond well to surgery are those that respond to proton pump inhibitor therapy. So if they don't respond well, they're not likely to respond all that great to surgery either. Pre-op evaluation, there is no consensus, but some of the strong recommendations from the ACG are an EGD. Esophageal manometry, you want to rule out motility problems. Like we talked earlier, some patients with achalasia can be misdiagnosed, and if they get fundoplication surgery with a motility problem of the esophagus, it can cause significant problems. A pH probe is usually recommended, also a 24-hour or 48-hour probe. So the surgery most commonly used is the laparoscopic Nissen fundoplication. Laparoscopic, as you can imagine, has some advantages over the open procedure, including decrease in post-op time to recover. So most patients are getting laparoscopic fundoplication now. The surgical therapy is effective as medical therapy for the carefully selected patient with chronic GERD, and the experience of the surgeon does make a significant difference in this type of surgery, like most types. So this is just a schematic of a fundoplication. Simply, if you're explaining it to your patients, they take the top part of the stomach and you wrap it around the lower part of the esophagus to tighten up that lower esophageal sphincter. So some of the post-op symptoms that patients may have, a lot of them will complain of dysphagia after the procedure. Some of them do require dilatation, but sometimes it improves on its own. Gas and bloating is common also, and frequently that will improve over time. If it's mild, you can recommend things like simethicone or charcoal tablets. You can give a trial of metoclopramide. If symptoms persist, you might want to consider a diagnosis of gastroparesis that may be newer, that may have been missed, that was contributing to the chronic gastroesophageal reflux disease. Long-term efficacy, about 90 to 95% of patients are satisfied with the results, and this is with an experienced surgeon again. So surgeries for peptic ulcer disease, we covered this a little bit, but indications include failure of non-operative management. So if endoscopically we're not able to control a bleed, they may need surgery, or for some reason there's non-healing ulcer. If there's a suspicion of malignancy in a gastric ulcer, then they would require surgery. Operations for duodenal ulcers are based on suppressing acid. So there's different types like vagotomy, antrectomy, and a gastric resection, also reducing the acid secretion. This is just a picture of different types of Billroths that you may have heard of through the years. The Billroth 1 is just the pylorus has been removed, where Billroth 2, the greater curvature of the stomach, is connected to the jejunum in an end-to-end anastomosis. So the operation for a gastric ulcer, the difference with gastric ulcers from duodenal ulcers, again, is that with the gastric ulcer, we're always worried that there might be malignancy. So you get generous excision if they require surgery, and then and biopsy of it. If they don't require surgery, if we're just doing endoscopy, that's why once we diagnose somebody with gastric surgery, we always make sure we go back to make sure it's healed completely. Post-gastrectomy syndromes include post-vagotomy, diarrhea, dumping syndrome, alkaline reflux, gastritis, and early satiety. Post-vagotomy diarrhea occurs in about 30% of patients. And most of the time, it's self-limiting. Pathogenesis is poorly understood. Oral cholestyramine Questran can be used and is helpful in some patients. I'm going to skip through the dumping syndrome, so that was covered already. But it's in your packet. All right, surgery for gallbladder. Acute cholecystitis, a typical presentation for acute cholecystitis. Acute cholecystitis is right upper quadrant pain, fever, and leukocytosis. It's associated with gallbladder inflammation, usually due to gallstone disease is the most frequent. Complications that can be life-threatening would be gangrene and gallbladder perforation. Treatment for acute cholecystitis is initially supportive. Antibiotics in some patients, the guidelines for recommending antibiotics would be in patients with elevated white count, elevated temperature, and radiologic findings of air in the gallbladder or gallbladder wall, advanced age, diabetes, and patients that have immune deficiencies. Timing of surgery for patients with gallbladder disease. Asymptomatic gallstones shouldn't be treated in the vast majority of patients. Low-risk patients with clinical improvement should have an elective cholecystectomy. Same hospitalization is recommended. Low-risk patients that have deteriorated need an emergency surgery. And then high-risk patients who are ASA 3 or greater, they have a higher mortality rate, obviously. So if those patients clinically deteriorate, you might want to look at putting a cholecystostomy tube in rather than surgery. So this is just a schematic of where the laparoscopic cholecystectomy, where they take it in a little picture. Complications from laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Serious complications can result in part from patient selection, surgical inexperience, and technical constraints from the minimally invasive approach. Bile duct injury is a serious complication. It can be, the type of injury is classified A to E based on the type of injury. I'm sure it's not important for you to know what each A through E means. The repair should always be approached in a multidisciplinary team. So if you're working in a small community hospital and there's a bile duct injury, then those patients need to be sent someplace where there's a surgeon, diagnostic radiologist, interventional radiologist, and gastroenterologist, preferably in a center that can treat these patients. Biliary leakage, you should suspect that in patients who have fever, abdominal pain, and bilious ascites. They may present with a large loculated collection. Percutaneous drainage can be used in those patients. ERCP can help define the leak, and also you can place a stent, and the bile will flow through the area of least resistance, so the stent, so that the leak can then heal. If they have severe pain or progressive intra-abdominal evidence of sepsis, then they may actually need reoperation. Other complications would include bleeding, bowel injury, post-cholecystectomy syndrome, which is a complex of symptoms that would include abdominal pain and dyspepsia, less common. So bariatric surgery, pretty much wherever you are, we have bariatric surgery in most areas. Becoming more and more common, so need the before and after care of the patients in between surgery. Complications from bariatric surgery can be divided into early complications versus late complications. The early complications are things that you would expect from any major surgery, bleeding, wound infection, leaks, pulmonary embolus, cardiovascular complications, pulmonary complications. And then later complications include some of the ones that we're going to talk about here. So stromal stenosis, so a narrowing at the at the opening. It can occur in about 60 to 20% of patients. The actual etiology isn't well understood. It could be from ischemia, or it could be the way the surgery was done. There may be increased tension at that anastomosis. Nausea, vomiting, dysphagia, and GERD are common, usually several weeks after surgery. And we can do endoscopic dilatation of these areas, and it's usually successful. It may take repeated sessions, but most of the time we have success with dilatation. Marginal ulcers can occur in about 1 to 16% of patients, and it's usually near, obviously, the anastomotic site. Causes for this could be from poor perfusion, possibly foreign material. Sometimes when we go in there as endoscopists, we'll see the staples hanging out and the ulcers right in that area. Excess acid exposure, non-steroidals. Patients post gastric bypass are using non-steroidals. Most of the time, surgeons and in the programs, they're checking for H. pylori before surgery, but the chance of H. pylori, and then patients that smoke, decreased healing. The presentation for these patients may be nausea, pain, bleeding, or perforation. Usually they'll respond to acid suppression, sucralfate. We use about plus or minus sucralfate, and usually about 95% of the time treatment is successful. So post-op ileus we see not uncommonly also. So it's a transient inhibition of normal GI motility in the post-op setting. Presumably the muscle of the bowel wall is transiently impaired and fails to transport the intestinal content. Most of the time it improves within 3 to 5 days, depending on what type of surgery the patient has and the severity of it. Clinical consequences from post-op ileus includes worse pain for the patient, nausea and vomiting post-op, delay in being able to start enteral nutrition, prolonged hospitalizations, increased risk of complications, and then increase in healthcare costs. So the pathophysiology isn't, again, well understood. Neural reflexes involving the sympathetic nervous system may inhibit motility, and that may be contributing. Epidural anesthetics may decrease the duration of post-op ileus, so how that plays a role needs further research. Local and systemic inflammatory mediators may play a role also. Non-steroidals will decrease the risk of post-op ileus. You know, clinically, how often can you use non-steroidals right after surgery? So, things that may make it worse, opiate analgesics, intraperitoneal surgery, the degree of bowel manipulation that's needed during surgery, open versus laparoscopic surgery, and then electrolyte abnormalities like hypokalemia. Clinical presentations include abdominal pain, nausea and vomiting, anorexia, abdominal bloating, distension, lack of passage of flatus or stool, tympanitic abdomen, and no visible peristalsis. So the pain is typically mild and constant with post-op ileus versus a mechanical obstruction where it's usually more severe and it's a crescendo, decrescendo. So that's one way to tell the difference between ileus versus a mechanical obstruction right after surgery. Physical exam shows lack of bowel sounds, increased abdominal girth, tympanitic abdomen, an x-ray air fluid levels, or non-specific bowel gas pattern. And here's a picture of ileus, again, non-specific bowel gas. Treatment usually is just waiting and supportive care, hydration, treating the electrolyte abnormalities. Unless there's nausea and vomiting, you don't need an NG tube, and it just is more uncomfortable if they don't already have an NG tube in because of surgery, just more uncomfortable for the patient. Some pharmacologic therapies that have been tested, randomized controlled studies don't really show a benefit in the metoclopramide, erythromycin. Laxatives show possibly some benefit. And then opiate antagonists may show some benefit in small studies, but more studies are needed. epidural anesthesia. So if you have a choice on what kind of anesthesia to use for whatever type of surgery they're having, if epidural, decreased risk of post-op ileus. Again, non-steroidals may be beneficial, but you have to be cautious because of the side effects. Non-pharmacologic NG tube, no evidence of benefit, may increase pulmonary complications, so use it only if the patient's vomiting. Early enteral nutrition appears to be safe and well-tolerated. Early mobilization, there's been no evidence that there's a change in the post-op ileus, but may decrease other complications, so worth trying. There are OMM techniques that have been shown to be beneficial, and then chewing gum has actually been shown to be beneficial, so have a pack of gum in your pocket.